Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult join us to talk about their new film, The Order.
If you like bacon, you'll love Oscar Mayer thick-cut bacon. It's smoked for 12 hours. That's a really long time. So for that delicious, smoky flavor, keep it Oscar. It's time for that once-a-year event, Truck Week, where you save big on America's biggest trucks, including the 12-ton, 12-liter, 12 hours of Oscar Mayer smoking thick-cut bacon. For half the day, they're still smoking that bacon. If you're driven by your love of smoky thick-cut bacon, keep it Oscar.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 331 of Real Blend, a podcast that's hosted by a couple of complete unknowns. Bang! How does it feel? I'm going to see that tonight.
We don't have the rights, Sean.
Ooh, that's no one knows what I just sang. There's something I wrote.
The inflection, I think, right?
How does it feel?
I'm Ron Burgundy.
You like that movie, huh?
Very much so. Very much so.
It's 220.
Is it really?
That's what I saw. Yeah. Is it not?
I mean, okay, but here's what I'll tell you. I am a Bob Dylan fan.
Oh, really? Oh,
okay. Yeah.
I'm not necessarily a Bob Dylan fan.
No, well, he's not a big fan of yours either. I've heard.
Publicly, Sean. Publicly,
that was great. Stated. That was really good. I do like Mangold a lot, though. So I'm curious to go into that. Hey, hello, everyone.
What are your thoughts on Mangold music biopics that feature Johnny Cash?
He's one for one in my book.
He's one for one. I think he's about to be two for two.
Big fan so far. On this week's show, hello, Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult are going to be joining us as guests to talk about their new film, The Order. We're going to talk about Moana box office, and we're going to talk about Wicked's Oscar chances. And then you guys would like to review the film Queer, starring Daniel Craig. So we're going to get to that later on in the show. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend, a co-host of the Real Blend podcast, joined this week in particular by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. And Gabe Kovach is joining us from Cinema Blend as well, too, sitting in for Kev, who is on vacation, currently touring a major city that I'm going to keep quiet just in case.
Boise.
Yeah. Tearing up Boise.
Our fans of Boise are
pissed. Town beige.
Yeah, this has been, it's kind of crazy because I know we mentioned Anora, like, earlier on another episode, and it just feels like so many titles are like flying by right now because we're seeing everything at the end of the year. Crunch. Yep. I watched Nosferatu last night. You had a chance to see that earlier. Gabe went to a screening of Queer. What else did you saw? The Brutalist recently.
I saw The Brutalist. I think the only thing I have left is Baby Girl and The Last Showgirl. Those are the last two.
Okay.
To complete my Girl trilogy.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Good. You saw Girl Interrupted first, I guess, is the first one.
Well, of course.
To prep.
Yeah, it's a legacy sequel.
I am going to complete Unknown tonight, which is the Mangold Timothy Chalamet film. And so what we'll do, hopefully, maybe a little bit later this month, outside of our top 10, is maybe just do a run through of like, hey, these are our reactions to a bunch of things that are in theaters right now, which is partially what we're going to do with talking about Moana's box office and a little bit more about Wicked. Hopefully, now that everybody's listening to this episode that just dropped, the one's going to have Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult, you also were subscribed to the channel and realized that earlier this week we dropped a exclusive interview with John M. Chu, joining us to talk about Wicked Part 1. Love, love, love getting filmmakers after their movie is out. We were talking about this before we started recording today, that it just feels like they can be a little bit more open. They can be specific about things that they worked on. John talked about a lot of the technical aspects of putting the film together, but I thought some really interesting things about the marketing of it and how they're responding to the reaction that the film is getting, which is great. It's a really, really interesting conversation. And I think that you guys are going to want to listen to that.
He was just in a very good mood for some reason. I can't imagine why.
Yeah. Although, reasons. I loved your question about the opening of In the Heights versus in the opening of Wicked.
I mean, thank you. I specifically wanted, and we'll jump into that. If you haven't heard the interview yet, the question is basically, look, I don't know if you guys remember the In the Heights opening weekend. A lot of people had very high hopes for that movie. I think initial projections, like some people were thinking like 20, 25 million, maybe even 30 million.
Yeah.
And I believe it open to like 11 or 12.
But wasn't that one of the titles that went to Max at the same time?
That sounds correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I seem to remember like pressing, cause I was like, oh, I want to watch the opening. I mean, but then again, so did Dune, and it didn't stop that, you know,
domestic opening was 11 and a half.
I think 11 or 12.
Yeah. Not bad. That's pretty good.
The amount of shit that I can't remember because I remember what In the Heights opened to.
Yeah.
Summers ago.
Somebody got to keep that on lock, you know?
That was a shame because I really loved In the Heights.
Yeah. No, it's great.
So, yeah, and I'm just sort of curious as to, you know, what a wild spectrum that he has seen in terms of his musical openings.
Well, and I don't think Wicked's going to slow down anytime soon, to be honest with you.
I mean, you know what's so funny, though, is it, maybe we've swapped spots. I'm curious as to, I don't know if it can cross a billion now, because I feel like it's not doing the numbers internationally.
It was never going to cross a billion.
I mean, it'll I think it could top out at like 700, 800, which would be huge.
Sure. Yeah, no, of course. That's a tremendous success. That's
an amazing number. But I think it needs to see a success internationally that's just not seeing right now.
I wish Big Kev were here on the show because he was Mr. Confidence that, oh, it's crossing a billion. Crossing a billion easily. So I like when Kevin's wrong. I love pulling up opportunities where Kevin's wrong. We're going to discuss Wicked and Moana a little bit more later on in the show. In the meantime, thank you very much for following the show. Hopefully you're watching us on the YouTube channel for the visual aspect of it. If you're here, give us a like and a subscribe. Share the show with a movie loving friend. I like to say that. Of course, we're available all the different places you get your audio podcast needs met, and you can sign up for Roblin Premium as well too. Sorry that we missed the Thanksgiving week.
Holiday off.
Yeah, we legitimately all packed up and got out of town. We're gonna be off this week with the newsletter. I'll be back at it next week. If you want to sign up for Roblin Premium, it gets you that newsletter. It gets you an ad-free version of the show. So you can find out how you can sign up for that at the description down below. I feel like we recorded this interview with Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult about 2 years ago.
It was early November, I think.
Yeah. September. No, it was September.
Was it September?
It was a while ago. They have a movie coming out called The Order, and they were doing early press day for it. And we pitched
a long
the idea
lead day, they call it,
of having both Jude and Nicholas Hoult come on the show. We love getting actors come on, in addition to the directors and filmmakers that have been joining us over the years and the below the line talent as well. And these two were fantastic. Breaking news, Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult are extremely charismatic. But in hindsight now, we got Jude Law for Skeleton Crew as well, too. Saw Nicholas Hoult in Nosferatu. So there's plenty of other things we could have talked to him about. It's really funny, too. Like, I got Aaron Taylor Johnson for Kraven. And then talk to him about Nosferatu as well. Like, everyone's double dipping at this time. There's just a ton of people out there who have multiple projects that they can discuss. But bottom line is, we were thrilled to have Jude Law and Nicholas Hoult join us on behalf of The Order. And so here's our official interview on the Real Blend podcast with both of those fantastic actors. And Nick, I want to start here. And I'm sorry if this is a basic start, but I'm genuinely curious what the energy is like on set on the day that you're filming a bank robbery or an armored truck heist. They seem crazy intense. We've seen those types of scenes done before. What are they like to actually lose yourself in one of them?
They are very intense and high energy. And it's something that we were actually discussing a minute ago, that Justin is a wonderful director, but one of the things he would also do to like invigorate and get energy out of us. I remember we were standing around one of the armored truck robberies, and he just, like, I'd see him run up to all the guys in the gang and push us all. Give me a push and be like, let's go. And that was kind of our little hype routine before going for it. And the only other thing is that you just lose your voice by the end of the day.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a long
screaming show.
Yeah, from just screaming like, get down, move. So it was a lot of energy in losing your voice. And then also, I mean, our shoot was quick for this movie. We 33 days. Mm-hmm. So to accomplish the kind of level of action in terms of how it was shot in the time frame we had was tricky, but luckily I had a very skilled team and it all kind of came together well.
That's cool.
I think it's really cool that Justin's brother Jed did the score for the movie. And I've always been interested in asking actors this question because I think it's a fascinating process, at least from an actor perspective, because we see the final product as an audience. But the emotional relationship that each of you have to seeing your performances set to music, and obviously in this particular instance, the score is done by the filmmaker's brother. So I'm just curious if that at all changed the process of it. But in general, over the years that you guys have been making movies, what is that emotional response like to seeing your performances set to score, and what does it reveal about the work you did?
The end product is always revealing, you know, when you see a piece put together, edited, finished with score. And obviously score used well can be an incredible element to the film medium. I remember with Anthony Minghella, he would often have the music and the musicians that were going to write for the film present. So we'd have music playing during the day, which was a wonderful way of capturing the right mood and spirit. And with this experience, I mean, what was clear was did you meet Jeb when he visited set? He came very briefly.
No, I didn't.
Justin has a very close group of work partners, and Jed is a key part of that. And they have a very intense and strong relationship. So I think it was clear he could lean on his brother's musical perspective, if you like, early on. But I had no idea what they were going to conjure up.
It's a very haunting, eerie score. Yeah. After the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, this isn't what I expected. Mm. It was magic.
Mm. And I believe...
Do each of you... Oh, sorry
I was just going to say, I believe a lot of those sort of almost didgeridoo kind of weird bosonic drones is his voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that's Jed. He kind of sampled his voice. Yeah, you know the whole...
Wow. Yeah, it's super unnerving.
I think that's his voice.
Yeah. It's wild.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, for each of you, do you have scores that come to mind of films that you've made in the past that were more revelatory? Like, obviously, you think of Hans Zimmer, obviously, on The Holiday, or Tom Hulkenberg, Junkie XL, and Mad Max. I mean, those are scores that are so huge parts of those stories. Like, do you have memories of scores that were more memorable for each of you?
The score to Road to Perdition was particularly good.
Thomas Newman.
Yeah. Oof.
The score, I listened to quite a lot to the score to A Single Man. I really liked the score.
Who did that? I remember.
Abel, what was his name? Karasowski. Karaskowski is something like that. It's a kind of simple piano and lots of times and strings, and it's a beautiful score. Sorry, I butchered the name.
No, I think you were right. Korzenowski.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good. Okay, I knew it was. Yeah. I was close. But I just can't remember.
I'm probably butchering it too, anyways.
Yeah, so. Don't butcher it like that. That's terrible.
I'm so sorry.
You know what? Also, yesterday, someone brought along an About a Boy album. Mm. For me to sign, and it was a badly drawn boy. Yeah. The soundtrack to that. Yeah, it was a great soundtrack.
God, it was such an era.
Yeah. It was really magic.
His voice just reminds me of such a particular period in England.
Yeah.
It was everywhere, and it's really great. Does he still write music?
I'm not sure.
He must do.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess I think so.
He was fantastic.
That
talented.
Whole soundtrack that was wonderful.
Yeah.
I think the really telling thing from your question is and I'm sure you've done this a few times where you've seen films before the score.
Mm.
And you sit there and you go,
yeah,
you're like, this is
rough.
and then you see it again with the score and whatever purpose. You're like,
yeah,
that works.
Or worse, I've seen my films with a temp score where they've just gone, great, Dylan, the Beatles, you know, and you watch it, you go, this is really working. And then they can't afford it. So they pop in something else. So when you do see it, you're like, oh, it doesn't quite have the impact when it's not, you know, Rainy Day Woman.
With like the songs written into scripts. And I'm reading it and I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. Yeah. I'm playing the song. And then like, yeah, we couldn't afford that. And you're like, oh, this is a really watered down version of the vibe we were going for.
Jude, I'm curious, you first read this script, how did you feel about the number of scenes that you two were actually going to have together?
honestly, I didn't particularly until we really got underway. And I still haven't gotten to the bottom of this. What happened was either planned by Justin, probably planned by Justin. The two of us were really making separate films. We were kept apart. I think the more that progressed, the more the crew got involved and quite liked, you know, making sure that we knew when the other was around so that we didn't have to necessarily interact. And it wasn't until the scene when we meet that we actually, we met each other and saw each other on this particular job. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. That's incredible. Cool. You know, this is something I know actors are asked a lot about accents but I genuinely find it fascinating because as somebody who's not an actor, you disappear in these roles and the accents are absolutely incredible. I mean, like I couldn't get over how different you sound from your real selves. And I remember hearing Hugh Jackman spoke about a sentence that he used. I think he got it from Johnny Depp. That allows him to get into an accent if he reads it in the accent. And I was just curious, since I have both of you together.
If only it was so easy. What's the sentence? It's clearly a magic trick because I've never been able to get that easily.
I could look it up. I could give it to you. But I am curious, since I have both of you side by side, how different your accent processes are. Because at the end of the day, like, do you stay in them? Do you call family and friends with the accent as you leave set? I'm just curious how each of your process works, because they're really incredible what you guys are able to do. And I think it's kind of an underrated thing about acting that you really become these people in that way.
We were working with the same... same guy on this, Tim Monach, who's really the sort of grandfather of dialect coaches. And he has an extraordinary library, I think probably the biggest in the world, of different accents. I mean, I can't answer for Nick, obviously. To me, it's always about being really, really specific. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough to say I'm from this state or I'm from this part of town or... It's like you want to know the street and you want to know what the parents sounded like. And then you can start really working on a sort of personality that is in the accent too. How was it for you with this? Because there were recordings of Bob Matthews.
There were recordings of Bob. And I do know what she was saying in terms of there being like a key phrase. Mm. Because once, same as you, you know, you want to figure out where the character's from and do all the research that kind of gives you the access to where what the sounds would be, and then start to figure out what the voice then sounds like. It was interesting with this because there were recordings of Bob, so you could get very specific on certain sounds that weren't necessarily that common to the American accents that he had.
Yeah,
the sounds that he had. But then it's also, yeah, there's occasionally there'll be something within the voice that does then a phrase or whatever it is that kind of clicks you into it. So in the morning, like I'll wake up and start and use that phrase, whatever it is. And then for this, I did talk in the accent throughout the day just because I found it easier, I think. Oh. But also I was trying to do like a slight, like this raspy voice thing as well. So I don't know, I was doing this voice that it was difficult for me to get in and out of. And
where you placed it.
Yeah. If I wasn't finding the placement of it right, you'd probably experience this. Then I'd start to panic because I'd be like, that's not sounding how it's meant to sound. Mm. And then because you panic, you then get uptight and then I really couldn't access it. So it would be like something where I'd stay in it. Once I got it, I'd stay in it because otherwise I was worried that I couldn't drop in and out of it easily. But I do also do different jobs where I'll drop in and out, and it just depends on the voice and how I'm working. I don't know. Yeah, this one I didn't.
It's certainly true to say, or I can say that some are easier than others. Some, I don't know whether it's because you're literally training your muscles in your mouth and in your throat to do something different. It's like, you know, they don't want to go in a certain way. So you have to teach them to go in that way by through repetition. And sometimes you can just do it by ear, but sometimes you really think, I can't get my mouth to do that. And you just have to practice and practice and practice. So some tend to be easier than others. Mm.
Nick, I want to ask you about the relevancy of the screenplay and this story. And there's a line in particular that hit me during a scene that you're in where it says, in 10 years, we'll have members in the Congress and in the Senate. And that's how you reenact, you know, real change, basically. And progress takes time. And it was then when I was like, the screenplay is really hitting, you know, sowing seeds and letting them plant and letting them fester for a really long period of time. Can you talk about your reaction to reading that bit of it and almost talking about how far back into history some of these, you know, shocking headlines and difficult headlines that we're reading today are addressed in this script.
Yeah, I mean, that was the surprising thing about reading this initially, knowing that it was a true story. I hadn't heard of this group or the crimes they were committing or their plan or the books they were referencing. This was kind of a complete part. And obviously we're all aware at the moment about the different groups that are kind of practicing similar sort of ideology and what's taking place. For it to be so relevant now, but to look back, and it even goes beyond the start of this story, with the John Birch Society and I mean, even going back to the Cold War sort of era, I think that was kind of some of the fear that provoked Bob Matthews, this fear of the outsiders and them and who's coming and who's going to take away this American dream. So I think he was distilled on him from an early age in that sort of fear as well. But yeah, I think Zach just did a wonderful job in terms of making things very relevant. And when you're watching it or reading it, you kind of go, oh, this is exactly kind of what we're experiencing today with January 6th and all these things and what people are planning and how they're going about kind of trying to take some sort of power and spread their word. But also at the same time, he doesn't hit you over the head with it. And Justin as well, in terms of his handling of the text and how he brings it to life. It's never something where it's preachy. And that's one of the first things as an audience myself and as anybody else, you kind of quickly switch things off when it feels like you're being taught a lesson or shown something too obviously.
Yeah.
You want to discover for yourself and learn for yourself and kind of unpick things. And that's what I think is magic about this film, about watching Jude's performance, about how Justin put it together. You gradually just unfurl things and you learn it and take it in. And it kind of is all bubbling just underneath the surface. And that's what's really magic about Zach's screenplay, Jude's performance, how Justin brought it all together and the ideas at play and what it's saying about society then and sadly now as well.
This episode of Real Blend is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. The holiday season is here, and what makes a better gift than one that keeps on giving, like a lifetime membership to Rosetta Stone? It's perfect for anyone looking to learn or improve their language skills. Rosetta Stone has been trusted for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's designed for long-term retention with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. And it's available on desktop and mobile, so you can continue to learn whenever and wherever is best for you. Give your family and friends the gift of language with 50% off all 25 languages for a lifetime and no shipping fees. RealBlend listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off when you visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Okay, bacon lovers, let me tell you something amazing about Oscar Mayer Thick Cut Bacon. Now, I don't know if you've used a smoker before, but it's a real labor of love. You gotta put in time to get that rich, smoky flavor. Now, think about this. Oscar Mayer smokes their bacon for 12 hours. That's half a day, twice as long as most bacon is smoked. So for that savory, smoky, thick-cut bacon, keep it Oscar. Tired of tossing and turning all night on your old lumpy mattress? Then it's time to upgrade your sleep game with a Restoform mattress. This state-of-the-art memory foam technology will have you feel like you're sleeping on a cloud for 12 hours or more. 12 hours? That's the same amount of time Oscar Mayer smokes their delicious thick-cut bacon. Yeah, while you're sleeping, Oscar Mayer is still smoking that bacon. Forget your mattress. For thick-cut bacon you'll dream about, keep it Oscar.
Kind of jumping off that question as well. I mean, as actors, you get to live the life of people that you're not, and you essentially get to view the world through a character's eyes. And you know, at the end of the day, when production's over, you go home to your real lives and you switch into a different film, etc. But I have to imagine that some of these projects, if not all of them, leave an impact on you, meaning the way that you actually walk through your life, the way you actually view the news when you're reading a newspaper or you're seeing a story on the news after playing characters in this story. I am curious what impact on your life perspective these two people gave you. And I know they're obviously very different people, and I'm just curious, like, if you are walking through your life viewing things differently after playing such a heavy film for an audience. I can't imagine what that's like for an actor to actually go through this emotionally.
Yeah, sometimes it is hard to shake off the mind state or the physicality. I've certainly had experiences in the past where my family made it clear that I wasn't in a good place, and and shaking off that kind of presence is welcomed. With this one,
Do you have a trick for trying to do that? Do you like
trying to get rid of it?
Do you go on holiday?
Go on holiday.
Two
more
times, please.
Cut my hair off and go on holiday. If you ever see a picture of me with no hair, it's usually I've finished a job and I'm trying to get the hell away from whatever loon I've just played. But with this one, first of all, I'll preface this by saying I think where Justin does such an interesting job with all his films, but particularly with this, is he puts his characters in their community. He kind of studies the family around them, and therefore you're looking at them as individuals and perhaps what it is that affects them or what they're striving for, what they want in their community. And so you're looking at a much more rounded sense of who they are as a person rather than playing something that's either black or white. He kind of looks at the gray area and tries to understand people's behavior. And I mean, honestly, for me personally, getting into the character was harder than coming out. I really didn't want to, it was a sort of masculinity to him that I didn't feel came naturally to me. There was a very... thanks. There was a sort of commitment to a cause that I didn't fully understand. And then there was this sense of being broken and exhausted. And it wasn't till I'd had a particularly long weekend with my young ones and with very little sleep. And I think I got a cold and I went in to meet Justin and he was like, oh, this is the guy. This is this guy.
You
this
got
kind
him.
Of sniffling, coughing, fatigued wreck. Can you keep this up? And once we sort of found him, replicating that became a place that I could go to. And I mean, I was I had a very, very good experience making this because it was very fulfilling and I loved the company I was keeping, but I was quite happy to step away from Terry. He was a husk. I mean, he's named aptly.
Yeah. 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 Jude, to that end, Terry is a veteran of this grueling battle. He talks often throughout the course of this story about slowing down.
Yes.
You know, and Journey kind of says to him like, go slow down.
Yeah. Yeah. Slow down then.
Yeah. And so it got me thinking about how busy an actor can be at the early stages of his career, taking anything that they can get just to keep working. And then going back over your resume, I looked at 2004, which is 20 years ago. I just want to read to you what 2004 is. Nicholas, you're going to be blown away by this. In 2004, Jude Law had Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow, I Heart Huckabees, Alfie, Closer, The Aviator with Martin Scorsese and Lemony Snicket. It's an insane amount of production that year. What do you remember about that year? What stands out?
They all
you,
come out that year.
They like, came out that year.
What, yeah, I didn't so make were they it. All shot the year before, or were they
no,
shot?
No, they were shot. I mean, first of all, a couple of them were.
It's a good run.
Yeah, it was a good run. What do I remember? I remember tired, fatigue. No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, there's a moment when I enjoy working and I enjoy the interaction of working, the lessons learned from working. And when people like Scorsese or David O. Russell, you know, offer you an opportunity, I mean, I'm just someone who loves to jump at that. I'm curious. I want to learn from them. And they were all, it was an interesting period because two of those were very small parts. I mean, it was literally me sort of popping in And one, I think, was almost just a voiceover, Lemony Snicket. I did the voice, and then they decided to do a day's shoot just to put me in it so you can kind of put a face to the voice. But it was a great time. It was a very exciting time. You know, you rightly said, when you start out, you just want to get a job. You just want to be taken seriously and earn. And then it becomes a job in that you suddenly think, I can choose. Like, what are the sort of films I want to make? What are the sort of statements I want to make? And if you're lucky, and I've had some very good fortune, you know, you get offers from some really exciting filmmakers. And to me, those are opportunities you can't walk away from. And that was very much at the peak of that time. Fell away a little bit after that, but things are going better now.
Things are going very well. Yes.
Yeah, you've had a very consistent career. You really have. You know, so that leads me to a question, and I feel like this could be kind of fun. Do you each have a favorite role of each other's? Because you both have incredible filmographies. You really do. I mean, like, and just that list just now is insane for your 2004 films, Jude. But do you? Yeah, I'm curious if you each have one.
I mean, oh man!
I watched Closer again recently, and that movie still is fantastic, and you're incredible in it. I've got to say, The Holiday would definitely be up there. That was on frequent play in my household growing up.
Yes.
Where else are we going here?
My turn. you mentioned Mad Max, and it was one of those experiences, and I think this is rarer and rarer, where you watch a film and you can't believe the actor you know is credited to the part is that person. I couldn't believe that was you.
That's good.
It was like it was a transformation, the energy and the physicality. Did you lose weight for it?
Yeah, I was like 160 pounds. I was very scared.
But this vitality that was just, I mean, mind blowing.
Like punk rock. It was punk rock.
Steampunk rock and devotion.
It was interesting, I mean, that you bring that one up, because in some ways there were similarities between that character and Bob Matthews in terms of that character. He believes that's devotion. His last day.
Yeah.
And he's going to Valhalla, and this is his. And so it was something I read a lot about, that sort of mindset for that film, and then going back into this and talking to Justin about it and where we believe Bob's head mind space would be and what his ultimate goal is and what he believes his journey and path is. It was kind of, in some ways, very different energy, obviously, but there was still that same focus and drive to it.
And A Single Man, do you see that also as that was another kind of big turning point I felt.
That was a lucky one for me, to get that. Do you have those where you're like, oh, I was lucky to get in there at that moment? So someone dropped out of that part.
Oh, you're kidding.
And then I got a call a week before being like, hey, can you screen test tomorrow for Tom Ford's film? And I was like, yeah, okay. And I didn't know who Tom Ford was. I didn't know the fashion world. And they were like, hey, you liked your screen test, can you jump on a plane and meet him? And I came to the Sunset Tower. We had dinner, and I was like, and I looked him up on IMDb, but all it said was Zoolander as himself. And I was like, well, this is a big jump. He's gone from playing himself in Zoolander to directing Colin Firth and Julianne Moore in this movie. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Anyway, we had dinner, and I chatted to him, and he was like, he talked very loosely, very humbly about like fashion and this, and I was like, cool. And then I went home, and I was like, I'll see what fashion he's talking about. And so I Googled his name instead of IMDb, and the first thing that came up was like him and Scarlett Johansson and Keira Knightley on the front of Vanity Fair or something. Yeah, and I was like, oh, and I started reading it. I was like, you're an idiot.
Empire building.
I was like, you're a clown.
Again, it felt to me like one of those bold decisions for you also, where it was really mature role, and it felt like a role that was suddenly like, in a classic film. Do you know what I mean?
He was a great director. The gaffer was there last night.
Oh.
At the screening. It was lovely to see him. But sorry, let's digress in. But he wrote a beautiful script for that.
That was a beautiful
And then I mean, I would honestly say that your performance in this is one of your all-time performances. And I was just saying that because it's a film that I'm now part of. If I saw this being no part of it, I don't see any of Jude in it. Oh, Mr. Ripley's got to be one as well. I watched Mr. Ripley go again, and I was like, God, you're so good at that. Mm-hmm. Going back. But this, I watched Jude in this, and I think it's just a performance where you're completely transportive as an audience member watching it, and so authentic and real. And I think it's I watch it as an actor and I go, oh, wow, I want to be able to do something like that. I think it's a masterclass, yeah.
Incredible. I'm so glad we got time to speak with you guys. I'll get you out of here on this one. Nick, obviously you see all the superhero shit behind me. I'm a diehard fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see your popcorn bucket right there, actually.
Yeah, I got Wolverine back here as well, too.
Hugh Jackman's big mouth.
It's very distracting for people. Your director, James Gunn, just shared his first look at Crypto. I want to know what Lex thinks of Crypto. Does he hate that dog?
You'll see when you see the film.
Damn! Come on. Well, thank you guys for coming on. We really appreciate you guys coming on. The movie's fantastic.
Thank you.
And you guys are really great in it. Thanks for your time.
Have a good one.
See you, mate.
Thank you so much to Jude Law and Nicholas Holt for joining us to discuss their film, The Order. This is a film that is going to be coming out on December. Well, it's in limited release now at this point, and then hopefully we'll be expanding out to more theaters, because I do think it's worth seeing. It's a throwback 1970s, 1980s feel of a gritty cop drama, with Jude Law playing a detective out in the Pacific Northwest who is tracking the early seeds of a white supremacist group. And what I loved talking to those two guys about is that they really are starring in two different movies that just happen to intersect at one given time. It's not dissimilar to Heat. They don't get necessarily a diner scene together, but you will find out that there is an opportunity.
Or almost like, would you compare it even maybe to like an American Gangster, where it's like two separate narratives and like they didn't really have a moment to the end?
Correct. Yes. And so with Jude Law's side, he's kind of a burned out detective who has been assigned to this case. He's trying to figure out his way around the Pacific Northwest. It has a little bit of an insomnia feel to it, and that he's never fully comfortable with where he is. He's dealing with a brand new team. And then on the other side of it, you see Nicholas Holt as becoming this charismatic leader of this burgeoning white supremacist group, and understanding how much power he has with that sect as it grows. And you kind of wondering the entire time that it plays out, like, are these two going to figure out who they are to each other? Will they finally be able to put the pieces together to cross? And I won't give away if that happens or what the developments are, but I was completely gripped, you know, the whole time through. Justin Kurzel is a director. He's an Australian guy who makes these sort of really dirty, gritty crime movies. I forget the name of the one that he had prior to this, but this is a really good film for him. I do want people to go see it in theaters. It's a totally different part for Jude Law. Like, it's funny that we got him for Skeleton Crew, because it's a reminder of how extremely polished and charming and movie star he is. Because in this one, he kind of disappears. It's like a character actor turn for him, where he just looks like he's beaten down. Snowtown, right? Gabe's correct. The film is called Snowtown. Really worth seeing as well, too.
Your 70s comparison is interesting, because the Jude Law part, you could almost have seen like an older, maybe like Charles Bronson in the part.
Yep.
Good call. I'm trying to think of maybe even like a Gene Hackman.
It's kinda, not, you know? Unlike, yes, that's exactly correct. Yeah. It would be almost like a French Connection sort of.
Yes.
Deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're looking for that type of tone, I would say go after that. It's tough, because it feels like right now, if you're not an awards contender, if you're not one of these titles being pushed, then you get swallowed. You know, I don't know if anybody's talking about The Order, isn't that, and they should.
That's this time of year, right? It is. If you're going to be a small movie, you better be one of the Oscar contenders. I mean, that's, and we often talk about when we come around and do our top 10 lists, you know, the thing I always try to emphasize to people is like, there are more than 10 great movies in a year.
Yeah.
Now all of my buddies, who whenever, you know, they'll call me if I've seen a movie or something, you know, a particular movie like this, their first question will be, is it going to make your top 10? And I'm like, well, no, but that makes it sound like it's a failure. Then it's not like, you know, like a movie. There are a lot of great movies that aren't going to make my top 10 this year, you know?
Yeah. I've already started putting together my list, and the ones that are off of it are great.
Yeah.
How are they not on it?
We always say that like slots 1 through 6 are easy. Like those are, you know, it's, the problem is 7, 8, 9, and 10, you usually end up with about 10 movies you need to squeeze into 4 spots. And that's why I think I love, Gabe, that we played that game in the past where we look back on our top 10 and we go like, oh my God, I can't believe I put that on there and not that, you know, it's always just, it's a timestamp of a moment.
For sure. It really is. Yeah. But anyway, I highly recommend The Order. Here's a good way to describe it. This feels like something that you would catch on Max and be like, that was a badass story, right? But it might have been like a 6-episode limited series that they stretched out too much. But instead, it's a really good movie that has two compelling leads.
I also feel like it's going to be the kind of movie that people rediscover. Like, it'll end up on Netflix in 3 years, and it'll be like the number one movie on Netflix. And then there'll be all those articles. It's like, this forgotten movie from 2024 is the most popular movie on Netflix.
Why do they sound like that?
Because that's what they sound like when they're stupid.
Other films that are coming out now around this time sometimes do the fall festival circuit. One of those movies is Queer, the new film by Luca Guadagnino. And Gabe, you got a chance to see it last night. And even though it has Daniel Craig and then who's the young actor who's Drew from Starkey. Outer Banks?
Thank you.
Drew Starkey.
Yeah. And this is one of those very humbling reminders that we're getting older. Because in my newsroom, a majority of the producers on my show are young women. They're very, very talented younger women. And whenever I mentioned doing this junket, I was like, oh, yeah, like I'm about to interview Daniel Craig. And then they went, Andrew Starkey? And I was like, well, yeah, but, you know.
Just from Outer Banks.
James Bond.
But James Bond. I've never watched Outer Banks. We've had Outer Banks people in the studio. And you would have thought the Beatles were coming through.
Popular show.
Yeah.
And yet, you know who I brought up to my kids the other day and they didn't even know who it was is J.J. Abrams' daughter.
Gracie Abrams.
Gracie Abrams. Yes. Yeah. And I said, I can't believe how popular Gracie Abrams is, because to me, I know J.J. Abrams kind of thing. And she seems like she's blowing up. And my kids were like, we don't even know who that is.
She had a concert here in Chicago a few weeks back and it was massive. And I had to have someone explain to me who she was.
Yeah,
and then that sounds terrible. But then I was basically like, JJ's daughter?
Yeah,
I think someone was literally like, oh, like her dad's a director, and I was like, JJ Abrams?
JJ Abrams. I know, that's the weird part that I'm in right now. I was like, how can this director who we've been following have a daughter who's old enough to be
in the 70s? People were like, there's this new actor, something Douglas. His dad's an actor.
It's probably right. Yeah,
Kirk Douglas.
All right. So anyway, you guys got a chance.
Sorry,
to see
Gabe, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Jake, no, you saw it earlier. Gabe, you saw it last night.
Yeah, I can
help. It's a recommend, but a it's cautious recommend, or?
That's an interesting question. I'll start because I think Jake might have more to say about it. I just saw it last night. And what I said to Jake leaving the theater was, I'm intrigued, I'm entertained, but I'm not sure I understand what I just saw. And not in a bad way. It's not that the movie didn't make sense or have like a through line that was interesting. It's sort of broken up into these three chapters and an epilogue. And I found with each chapter, it was more interesting. Like right as the first chapter, I was like, all right, this is getting a little long in the tooth. It was like chapter two. Now they're on a bit of an adventure. And it was like, great. Like, this is exciting. And then it sort of kept going. I think that if you're a Luca fan, or if you're familiar with this author, from what I understand, you will like this. I was able to speak with someone who was familiar with his writing afterwards, and he seemed really excited about it. And I was like, is that what you were expecting, or was this kind of like off the wall crazy? And he's like, oh no, that's what I was expecting. I was like, okay, great. Like I'm just uninformed on who this is or this type of work. I thought Craig is amazing. They're both amazing. Sorry, the gentleman's name again from
Drew Starkey.
Starkey. They're both great. Drew Starkey is really great. He kind of plays like a bit of an enigmatic, not mysterious, but just he's sort of like emotionally reserved. You don't really know what he's thinking. And he kind of shifts and changes throughout the movie. And he I thought he did a really great job of playing that. And Craig
is it a period piece? Is it contemporary? What?
Yeah, no, it's set in like the 50s, I think. Is it? It's okay. Set in like it starts in Mexico City in the 50s. And then I think it covers, you know, like a couple years by the end of the film. But Craig is amazing. Craig is really great in it. It's like a great piece of character work. And I think Daniel Craig, having played James Bond and kind of being, I think, super recognizable, there's a risk of, and there are moments of this where it's a little bit, there's a risk of him feeling like Benoit Blanc or James Bond, you know, like seeing similar strokes, but I feel like he goes off the wall. He plays some really interesting, has some really interesting choices. I won't say what it is, but there's a scene, Jake, the first time that you learn about something that he does, and it's a very long, 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 long take where I was sitting there, like I had time to go like, oh yeah, that's interesting. And then being like, wow, he's really acting the shit out of this quiet moment. And I'm like, he's still acting. Like this is still going.
Acting with a capital A.
And it's very subtle. And the shot ends, and I go, wow. Like, you're just kind of blown away by like, how were you able to maintain that for as long as you did? With it's he's doing almost nothing. And it's very, very interesting. So performances are great. I felt like it moved. I wasn't, like I said, by the time it started, I feel like it was slowing down. It was like the film knew and picked back up. It gets sort of ramps up and gets sort of crazy in the back half is all I'll say about that. Which allows Luca to do some really striking, really interesting, visual tricks, which feel completely different than sort of the opening of the movie, which I really enjoyed. It is a strange film. I don't know that I understand it. I'm excited to learn more about it. Jake gave me a little bit of info, which led me to like, okay, I just need to learn more about this to understand what's happening. It's a recommend if that sounds interesting to you. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person that wants to go in knowing the actors, knowing the director, and knowing nothing. And I did know nothing going into this, and maybe that was to a detriment. Like I said, I was entertained. I'm excited to learn more about it, but I think maybe if you're more familiar with this story, you might get more out of it. Jake, what did you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. So the movie is based on a 1985 book by an author named William S. Burroughs, and it was a book that he had written a while back, and I think ended up being talked into publishing. And it's kind of semi-autobiographical about his time spent starting out in Mexico City, and then a journey he ended up taking with a young man that he met there. Last act is basically like a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas kind of
meets. The Lost City of Z.
Yes,
it's like, yeah. It's that.
But here's what I'll say is that there are these, you know, it starts out as a pretty straightforward narrative and then just jumps into these like wild, well, what do you think it means kind of imagery. And as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, I don't know what I think it means. I don't know. Like, I wish someone would tell me because I don't know what any of it means. Yeah. But just as an example, so I started looking up because he's not I don't think the name of the character is William S. Burroughs, but he's basically playing. And it's so much so that even in my interview with the guys, I asked the question I often ask, which is if you could sit next to, you know, the person. And we talked about if they could have sat next to William S. Burroughs. So he's basically, that's who Daniel Craig is playing. And so I did a little homework on the guy after having seen the film, and it made a lot of the stuff in Queer make sense. A lot of the imagery, like I would read things about him and go, oh, that's what that random out of context moment in the movie meant. For example, and I'm going to put the spoiler alert tag out there and Gabe, feel free to cut this if necessary. There's this imagery of a woman with a bullet hole in her head. And imagery of like him, like attempting that her putting the a shot glass on her head. And from what I read, William S. Burroughs was married to a woman at a time and accidentally killed her while they were attempting to play like a game of like William Tell, him attempting to shoot the glass off the top of her head. That image is presented in the film without any context of, right, hey, this is, he's haunted by the ghost of his wife kind of thing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's an example of like, oh, I really wish I had done more homework on who this man was before I started watching, because it would have made particularly a lot of things in the latter half of the movie make sense, as opposed to just imagery and hallucinations that out of context meant nothing to me. So it's a bit harder to judge. I agree with everything that Gabe said. And I don't know if I like it enough to go back and rewatch it with the context that I'd be given, but I wish that my first time with it had been different.
I might read the book. Like, if that means, like, I'm curious if the book is less ambiguous, because it feels like that sort of art house approach of a film of, I mean, it's one thing to end your film in an ambiguous way that sort of leaves you guessing, but it really, scene by scene, there are moments where you're like, okay, what happened? That happen?
Right.
Why did that happen? Does this mean this? And not in a bad way. Like, I wasn't frustrated by that. There were moments where, like, I'm trying to think of things that aren't spoiler or how to present them.
I mean, okay, even like imagine like the last 10 seconds of Challengers, but presented over an hour or the whole time. You're like, well, what happened?
There are moments where, like, you know, an entire chapter took place, and then you get to the end of it, and I went, oh, is it about to be revealed that like that was a hallucination or something? Like, like, is it going to be one of those type thing? Like, it leaves a lot of things to be yeah, open for interpretation and probably makes for a really fun rewatch if you enjoy it. I've just seen it maybe in a couple of days, it'll wear off. I have a lot of lingering questions that I'm excited to try to
I think very much so deserves one of the five actor slots.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
Craig?
He's
incredible.
Yeah. He will be one of the best five.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting.
I would think right now, let's see.
I would say, Sean, like in under that, if you're someone who, yeah, is interested in the awards race, is interested in that conversation, I would say you, I don't know if you have to see this movie, but you have to see Daniel Craig in this.
Because right now, that kind of narrative structure frustrates me to no end. So,
oh yeah.
So you guys have not sold me on it, but sure. I am interested to see Daniel Craig if he's really good.
It's going to be Coleman Domingo. It's going to be Brody. Adrian Brody.
Yeah.
Chalamet.
Okay.
Daniel Craig.
Ralph Fiennes.
That's it. That's the five.
Do you think you've seen all of those, right?
Yes.
Do you think this is, you know, spoilers for when we discuss this later in 3 months or whatever that the Oscars are. Do you feel like Brody's a lock? I feel like a couple weeks ago we were like, oh, yeah, Brody just has it.
I felt like Brody was a lock. I mean, right now I'm seeing this surge for Chalamet, and it could just be because the embargo is up and he's about to be out doing press and stuff like that. So, yeah. But then again, you know, there's always, Sean and I were just saying the other day, it's a long way till March.
Yeah.
And I still, there's a part of me that feels like Conclave could like swing back around and surge at just the right time.
He's great.
What about Dwayne Johnson for Red One?
I think they're he's campaigning for supporting.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
Because I think the lead actor has to go to the publicity team for trying to pretend that movie's good.
Well, that's very nice. Well done.
The big story in the industry currently is the rejuvenation, at least for the time being, of the box office, thanks to powerhouse performances by Moana 2 and Wicked, and to a lesser extent, but still, Gladiator 2. Coming off the last weekend, I just want to point out some statistics. Moana 2 posted $139.7 million in 4,200 theaters. It has pushed its total gross domestically to $225 million. Wicked has added another $81 million. It's now at $263.1 million. Jake mentioning earlier whether it was going to get to a billion and not quite doing as well worldwide. But again, could end up playing for weeks and
I think there are massive markets it hasn't opened in yet, but I also just don't think it's doing the numbers required to get it to a billion.
Is there a chance that gets a resurgence around Christmas time, Christmas break?
Well, they're going to do the sing-along versions bringing back into theaters.
Look, it's America. People are singing along where they want to.
That's fair.
Basically. Yeah, but I wanted to bring it up from this perspective because it blows my mind that most of the reviews from Moana 2 pointed out the fact that this felt like something that had been designed, because it was, for Disney Plus. Mm. It feels a little episodic. Yes, so it feels a little episodic.
Did you guys see it?
I did not
see it, but I asked people if you could feel, because I've read from a few people that you can feel the episodes.
Really?
That you can feel like, oh, this is probably around the time where there would have been a break. I honestly kind of want to see it for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. And I love the first Moana. I think I've told this story on the show before that, like,
yeah, I did too.
Had a press screening for it. It was on a Monday night, kind of at the end of the year. We're all dragging. We're heading into the holidays. It was Thanksgiving holidays. And I had a screening of it. And I said to Bren, who is a little younger at this point, and I was like, Bren, I got a screening of Moana. I'll go if you want to go, you know, but otherwise I'm content to stay home. And he goes, yeah, I kind of want to see that. Let's go. And so the two of us went, and we came back from it and couldn't stop raving about it to Michelle. Wow. We were like, the animation's incredible. The songs are unbelievably good. And she was like,
lost that year to Zootopia. And I remember being like, Moana is so much better than Zootopia.
Oh, I also like Zootopia too.
But I thought Moana was special.
It is. Yeah, no, it's really great. And so but now like we're getting a live action Moana too, which is, seems like we're saturating the market.
You know, yeah, that's what we need.
Yeah. That's such a strange, that's a whole different thing of like, we're making a live action remake while we're still making sequels.
Yeah, it's a lot. But the topic I wanted to bring up, and I kind of broached this with you guys beforehand, is how much it feels to me that the existence of these streaming services, Disney Plus specifically, is drastically damaging our franchises, which we should be, quote unquote, relying on to produce really entertaining movies. And I started thinking about Star Wars more than Marvel, although Marvel's definitely suffering from it.
I'd throw Marvel in there.
Well, my point being with Marvel is I don't know if we ever would have gotten like a She-Hulk movie or a Hawkeye movie.
And I like both those shows.
They're fine. Yes, yeah. they're fine for what they are. But it feels like if some of these ideas, if Daredevil Born Again, right, was saved for a movie and you were getting Charlie Cox and John Bernthal and Vincent D'Onofrio and they're coming back to do a Daredevil movie, right? Like it would be like, holy shit. And the example I gave you guys beforehand was Obi-Wan Kenobi. If that show was the next great Star Wars movie, like I feel like we've had this dearth of incredible Star Wars movies, and instead they're being stretched out and watered down for these streaming series. The last Star Wars movie was,
correct me if I'm wrong, Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, which is 2019.
Before the pandemic.
Yeah. I would say, I think the Star Wars example is a little bit, the movies hurt the movies too. I think that if coming off of the Skywalker saga, the movies were crushing and everyone was loving it, they might be more enthused about making an Obi-Wan movie. But I think the impetus was like, well, streaming is this new thing and we're trying to push it. Well, this isn't working creatively, it seems. Right. So let's do this. I think it's a bit of both column A, column B of you got to make good movies to make people want to come see your movies. Mm-hmm. And I think that holds to be true. But
because I give a lot of credit to even Pixar deciding earlier this year that we're going to put Inside Out just in theaters, exclusively in theaters. And currently it's the number one grossing movie at the box office. Yeah. I just want to ask you guys if you think the pendulum is kind of swinging back the other way, that while the studios understand that they have to populate streaming, they're putting a little bit more weight. And I'm not saying that Moana is the decision that's changing everything, but are they going to look at these numbers and think like, all right, maybe we have to save some more things for theatrical and bring back that special experience?
I think the pendulum sort of metaphor is apt. I think it's streaming is not settled yet. Like, I think we're still in this mode of streaming being very new relative to sort of the traditional industry. And I think that's the lessons that they're still learning. And I think Moana is going to be something that they pull from. I think you see these numbers and you have an example of, we were going to make this a show. Imagine if we didn't make, I don't know, what do you guys think it's going to end up with? 750 million? Like, I don't know what it ends up at, but I don't think they're making that in Disney Plus subscriptions with a Moana show. So I think it is a good example. And I think it's something that I hope they take a lesson for, is that, you know, we should really be, is there, like, I don't know necessarily what the end is for streaming, but I think that for a long time it made sense that movies existed and home video existed, and that I don't think that was just a moment in time, and I think that there was something that made sense to people in the way that they interact with media. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're not, that it's going to be, hey, we're going to go back to those days exactly, but I think more and more we're going to see these streamers, which are now, you know, sort of all becoming one thing anyway, taking the theatrical stuff more seriously and taking that into their business in streaming. I think we've said it for a long time. I know I've said it on the show forever of, I really want to see Netflix embrace theatrical and see theatrical as a way to make money for these movies and things that they're putting on that really last a week and then disappear, and, and giving yourself, you know, it doesn't have to be 45 days, but give yourself 2 weekends, give yourself a month in theaters to make $60 million back on a $100 million budget, and then put it on Netflix. And everyone who's going to have Netflix is going to watch it there. Do I have all the numbers? Can I make, you know, the same call that their accountants and their producers can make? Maybe not. You know, they have more information than I do, but to me that seems like an inevitability, that you need to lean into this theatrical model, that people are coming, especially families with these animated features, to support them.
Yeah.
And so you should try to get as much as you can out of it.
You know, In true Hollywood fashion, everything is cyclical. We've been through this before. Like, Disney has been through this before. Like, Gabe and I are of the generation that, Gabe, you're a little bit younger than me, so maybe, because I was a kid when this happened, but I am of the Return of Jafar generation. Do you guys know what that is?
Yeah.
The straight-to-video Aladdin sequel that could not even get Robin Williams back as the genie because he was pissed off at Disney at the time. And you know, all of those straight to VHS Disney sequels. That obviously were much lower in quality, much easier to produce, but you put out there and every kid wants it and you can sell it at the time. I think it was like $14.99 a pop. And you know, there was a way for them to bring in revenue. Toy Story 2 was that close to what was supposed to be. I think it was originated as a straight to video sequel until I think someone made the decision like, you know, we should probably put this in theaters. Like we really should. And then they put it in theaters and it was one of the biggest hits of the year. And then I think that sort of very similar to what we're seeing now, I think served as a rejuvenation and a reminder of like, there is value in putting quality movies or putting big movies that people want to see in the movie theater. You know, there's been so many conversations that I feel like were silenced over this past weekend about whether or not people are willing to go to the theater anymore. And a lot of the detractors have been the quality of the movie theater, the quality of the theatrical experience, and obviously what people have available at home. And this weekend just proved between Moana and Wicked and Gladiator that if the right movies are there, people will go. People will get off their ass and go to the theater. It has to be a thing, you know. But so I feel like in the same way that we experienced this in the 90s, we're about to experience it again, where they were lulling on the straight to VHS sequels, just in the same way that they were lulling on, well, just put it on, you know, we need to keep people on Disney Plus. And listen, let's be honest, a majority of streamers' income comes from people who forgot that they signed up for the streamer in the first place.
Yeah. Well, like a Disney Plus has now figured out a way forward where they're bundling with ESPN, right? So now you're getting it for other reasons. Yes, you're picking it up for other reasons. So it's not just we have to get you in the door. Yeah. Now we've got you in the door. We're getting you in front of the reason. So my only hope is that we often talk about Hollywood taking the wrong lessons from success. I hope the success of Moana 2 makes them realize that, like, hold on, wait a second. Let's rescue a few of these things, you know, from the streaming service.
Is the wrong lesson. Maybe we should hire TV writers, write a TV show, and then smash them all together and call it a movie.
I feel like the only lesson that Hollywood's going to take from the success of Moana 2 is, so are we working on Moana 3 yet?
Moana 3, baby.
Moana 3.
Here we go.
So is there going to be a Moana live action? Is there going to be a Moana 2 live action in theaters while Moana 3 animated is out? Is that going to happen? Is that going to happen?
That's the MCU I want, baby.
Is Moana?
I want them to cross over.
Is Moana live action the story of the first movie?
I assume so.
I think so.
we just had it. Like, it's not, this isn't 20 years that have gone by.
You're correct.
And it has The Rock. Rock is playing Maui.
Himself. Yeah, he's
unbelievable.
Kudos. Shameless. It's absolutely shameless.
Wow. That's amazing.
You know what? You know what? Marvel should just make Endgame again.
Yeah, why not?
Let's just remake Endgame.
Animate it and put it in theaters.
I'd watch it.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, to be fair, you know, we did just get a remake of Gladiator.
Yes, we did.
True.
Yes, we did.
I'm just kidding. Right. I actually like Gladiator too.
Anyway, no, you said on a rewatch.
I rewatched. We got the. We're so spoiled. and I feel like Sean, you can probably appreciate this. My family was here over the weekend, and obviously it's a big movie weekend, and my family's big movie goers. And I said, all right, guys, you guys want to go to the movies? You want to see Wicked? You want to see Gladiator? And they went, yeah, sure. You got a screener? Can we watch it at home? And I was like, you spoiled brats.
I know. We've ruined
And that was
them.
Right when those screeners hit. And I was like, yes, I do.
Hey, you bought that new TV, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Gladiator 2 did not hold up in the rewatch the way I'd hoped it would. It felt
now,
long.
Your parents were seeing it for the first time. Did they dig it?
Yeah, they really liked it.
Okay.
They really liked it. But they didn't have they don't have the connection to the first one like we do.
Okay. You know who else complained during the rewatch of it? Ridley. He wasn't crazy about it. He found problems with it. One of the conversations we've been having around the Real Blend offices
around the water cooler. Is whether or not. Yeah, we have a water cooler. You don't go fill up at it during the day.
I think this is technically the water cooler. Just this part.
Listen, it's no, it's December. I was going to say it's November. It's December. We understand. It's first week of December. So there is 6 months left to go or whatever. Until the Oscars get here. But at the moment, is Wicked the front runner for let's say Best Picture. Do you want to go deeper than that? Are we talking, are we just talking Best Picture? Because I've
let's,
seen
let's
some.
Just, let's talk about because it went from
the state of the race
Wicked
right
gonna
now
be nominated to oh, it's going to be nominated. But now it's a could it actually win?
One of the interesting things I've heard is Wicked is going to win Best Picture, but John Chu might not even get nominated.
Yeah. Like, well, can I throw out that stat that I told you the other day?
Oh, please. Yeah, that's really interesting.
So, yeah, I you know, if you I follow the Oscars pretty closely and I kind of keep my finger on the pulse of what a lot of the experts are saying. I don't consider myself an expert in the category, but I do sort of keep, you know, up to date on sort of where things are moving around.
We call it Oscarology, Jake.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. And the general consensus is that while Wicked is a front runner to win Best Picture, most people agree that John Chu will not be nominated for Best Director and the movie will not be nominated for Best Screenplay, which usually a Best Picture winner needs a package, right? Like it needs in his picture actor screenplay or picture director screenplay, or, you know, there's something, you know, it needs like a nice little neat package. The stat was tossed out that I found very interesting, that the last time a movie won Best Picture without being nominated for Best Director or Best Screenplay is Chicago, find very, very interesting.
That is pretty cool.
Does it suffer at all from we're getting a sequel next year?
Here's what's interesting is there. You're asking like because it's a part one.
Yeah, like it does it get the, I know it's not a trilogy like Lord of the Rings, but does it get.
I'm not seeing that narrative around Wicked the same way that I saw it a few years ago around like it was around Dune.
Because I feel like maybe because that could happen. That's the narrative that could change in the next few months. That's one thing. And whenever we get further away from the release and we talk about the Oscars for another 45 weeks, that they're but you know, the next one's coming out in five weeks.
I think that's why Universal is being very smart in that they said, because earlier this year we got our first look at Wicked in during the Super Bowl, and they said we're not releasing a Super Bowl preview of Wicked 2. We're going to make people miss us is what they said. I think that they are kind of holding back on pressing hard on reminding people that 2 is coming out. But 1 also feels very much like a complete story.
It does. Yeah. So here are the two other options that I'm seeing now. I'm seeing that the race could come down to Wicked versus Dune.
For Best Picture?
For Best Picture.
No, Dune doesn't have a chance.
You don't think Dune has a chance?
No, I think it's right now. I think it's Wicked versus Anora.
Anora. See, because the other thing I'm hearing is that the Brutalist is going to sweep all the categories. Like, Brutalist is going to clean up. It's going to get picture. It's going to get director. It's going to get Guy Pearce. It's going to get Adrian Brody.
I mean, it got the New York Film Critics Circle. Here's my thing is a lot of people are comparing it to like a Power of the Dog, that like it'll play strong, but then it won't end up actually delivering when the moment comes, or Aroma.
Okay.
Where it'll be a beloved critic darling.
Right.
But then won't actually.
Okay. That's depressing. I would like to see Wicked right now. I would like to see Wicked win Best Picture.
I think if the Oscars were held today,
yes,
I think Wicked wins. Anytime a movie peaks in December, there's a part of me that goes, well, that's not going to win.
So let's talk about Anora then. And when we can do a proper review of Anora later, because I know Kev is a huge fan of it.
I think that's going to come up on our top 10 episodes. So we'll have
I would assume.
To, yeah.
Yes.
I don't think Anora has a chance in hell.
Can I tell you that's on Gold Derby, which we're far out and it's just one thing. That's their across 31 nomination predictions. That's their highest odds of winning.
Number one, really?
Yeah, right now.
Yeah, man. I don't see it for that movie. I just don't.
I think Sean Baker has screenplay in the bag.
In the bag? You can't say anything's in the bag in December.
I think Sean Baker right now, if you gave me $1 million, I think screenplay goes Anora and Conclave.
Okay. And Conclave, you think, feels like a movie that could withstand the early push. Yeah, because
what I'm finding to be interesting is that it's sort of threading the needle in terms of like prestigious Oscar type of drama, but also seems very accessible for people. It's the number one movie on VOD right now. I think if it ends up on a streaming service before voting, it did for that type of movie. It played very strongly at the box office. I think it cleared like 30 million domestic, which for that kind of movie in this market right now is big. There's clearly an interest in it at a time where all these big movies are on VOD, and that's the number one movie on VOD right now.
Right.
It feels like a movie that and that a lot of people really, really like.
But either way, it's shaking out to me to be a year where not one movie powers through and sweeps.
I would agree. And I love years like that. I mean, just yesterday, based on this recording, we had a wrench thrown in with A Different Man winning Best Feature at the Gotham Awards, a movie that I honestly, you know, it makes me happy because, like, I got to be honest, of the two Sebastian Stan movies released this year, to me, that was the one that deserves more attention. I really hope that Adam Pearson gets more supporting actor attention. I'd love if he entered the Oscar race.
Right.
I gotta be honest with you, having rewatched Gladiator 2, I don't think I see, unless they just really want to give Denzel a third Oscar, I don't see that. I mean, he's very good in the movie.
Sure.
But, like, I don't know that I'd give him the Oscar for it. Like, I feel like that kind of role he could play in his sleep.
Okay.
Like, I'd vote Kieran Culkin over Denzel.
Yeah, I would too. Kieran Culkin was outstanding in A Real Pain.
Yeah.
But that movie, to me, is just perfectly fine. Like, it's fine.
Well, you're talking about A Real Pain?
A Real Pain, yeah.
I think A Real Pain could be, like, one, like the 8, 9, or 10 slot for Best Picture.
I could see that.
Jake, do you want to know where Goldberry has it?
Yeah.
8.
I swear to God, I don't, as much as I say, like, I read a lot of articles and watch a lot of videos, but I don't go on Gold Derby.
You declared yourself an expert in Oscarology.
You should be one of these experts.
Did I literally lead off being like, I'm not an expert in this?
You did say, I think you are. So you think Mikey Madison for actress then? You think she has it locked up? Right now, Variety has Mikey Madison, Cynthia Erivo, Angelina Jolie for Maria, Carla Sofia Gascon for Emilia Perez, and Marianne Jean Baptiste for Hard Truths.
Who won the New York Film Critics Circle?
Did she really?
Best Actress today.
So I watched Hard Truths. I watched Hard Truths over the weekend. The new Mike Leigh film. Here's the type of movie. We've seen so many films, and it's one of those films where it's a slice of life story of two sisters. They're each dealing with the loss of a parent, and how emotionally they're taking it in two different directions. One, played by Marianne Jean Baptiste, is completely angry and disgruntled with the world, and her relationship with her husband and son is strained because she's gotten so bitter. Her older sister is more of a optimistic, glass half full. And because of that, her relationship with her two daughters is thriving. And so you see how their dynamic is playing off of each other. But it's one of those films where not a lot happens. And then I got to a point in the film where the camera was sort of just panning off to the side. And I turned to Michelle and I said, this is going to be the end of the movie. The credits are going to roll right now because nothing had really happened. And then sure enough, it's directed by Mike Leigh. And I was like, perfect. Like, nothing happens in this movie, but I just knew we had reached the conclusion of, this is how far I'm going to push this story.
Yeah.
She's fantastic. I think she's great. The movie is what the movie is, but I could see her definitely getting in. So, Emilia Perez feels like it's losing steam.
Very
I don't hear
so.
People talking about it at
Very
all. I don't so. Hear, I don't see Netflix pushing it as hard as they were.
And what's interesting is I think the biggest impact that could have is on the supporting actress race, because right now Zoe Saldana, who was, I think, the front runner for supporting actress for a long time. If with that movie losing steam, I think it's allowing Ariana Grande going back to Wicked to potentially make a surge for, there are a lot of people that think that she could be the winner.
Explain to me how Glinda is a supporting part.
Wait, say that again.
How is Glinda in Wicked a supporting part? How is that supporting actress? That's category fraud, bro.
I mean, how is Zoe Saldana?
True. At least you could make the argument that that's a three-headed monster, that story.
Okay, you know? But all three should be. They're pushing Selena Gomez and Zoe for supporting actress.
Right.
That's the game, baby.
So frustrating. That is so frustrating. You cannot watch Wicked and tell me either of those is a supporting actor.
What about A Real Pain?
They're leads.
Are either of those supporting?
No, they're in the same amount of scenes together. How is that supporting? That's crazy to me. That's so frustrating. That's not fair.
That's the game, baby. And you know, and when live action Moana comes out,
yeah,
it'll be The Rock.
When The Rock gets best actor. Oh, he's going to be supporting
the chicken.
Live action Moana. That's my new obsession. Oh, God.
Is the chicken going to be like a Lion King live action chicken?
Probably.
Boy, oh boy.
Fingers crossed.
When do you see Mufasa?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh, yeah. Wow. You got to text me after. I want to hear how that is. I'm deadly curious. Curious?
Deadly serious? Curious.
Listen, I don't have a great reputation for talking about the Lion King remakes on this show.
Well, I'm just text me quietly in the thread.
The name of Sean's new mystery novel, Deadly Curious.
Deadly Curious. The new Benoit Blanc. All right. Let's land this plane. So right now we want to hear what?
Can I throw one thing out there? Do we have time for like 2 minutes?
I guess so.
Just because we were talking about Wicked, I experienced something really interesting over the weekend, and I can't tell if it's the product of, so I've talked about these a lot, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra doing, they did Wizard of Oz over the weekend. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's likely they have something similar in your town. They play the movie on the big screen and a local symphony orchestra will play the music live.
Yeah. It's a ton of fun.
It's very fun. And it's such a cliche, but it really is like seeing a movie you love again for the first time. It really, it's a whole new experience. I had not seen Wizard of Oz. And easily, I'm almost 37, over 30 years. I mean, we're talking like I had to have been a child the last time I really sat down and watched Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. So I had this memory of it in my head, but a lot of it for me was sort of like, oh, I don't really remember this part. Like some of the parts are just it's so ingrained in pop culture, but there are a lot of parts I did not remember. This is going to sound crazy. I did not remember it all being a dream.
Yeah, see, I don't remember that either. You brought that up, and I still don't remember it.
Really?
That's kind of the whole thing, right?
See, that's that. Okay, then that's what everyone I talk to, they're like, well, yeah, that's. But for some reason, in my mind, if Dorothy went to Oz.
But she thinks it's a dream, but then when she sees the people on the farm and realizes that they look like Tin Man and Scarecrow.
I don't think she ever realizes it. I don't think she realizes. You know, but it does show her when the tornado comes through, it does show her being hit on the head by something and falling back on the bed. And that's when kind of the camera goes. And so when she comes out of it, you know, it's you know, everyone sort of gathered around her and she tries very, diligently to convince everyone, hey, this is, this thing happened. Everyone's like, oh, okay, all right, Dorothy, you're so stupid.
Yeah.
But the ending is it was all a dream. And I have no memory of that.
Wow.
In my consciousness of pop culture.
I don't blame you. I mean, honestly, like you said, it's been 30 years since you've seen it and you've watched a bazillion movies since then. It still holds up though. It still plays.
Oh well. Yeah, it holds up. But I wish in this giant theater when the credits rolled, you almost could have heard a guy go, what the fuck? Like, I was so shocked.
Yeah, the sound of a single gasp.
I was the one guy that like was surprised by a movie that's been out for literally almost a century.
I could see how you could forget it because it's not the things you remember from it. And it just happens in like a moment. I think it's totally. I imagine you're not alone. It sounds like Sean was the same way. But yeah, I specifically remember the imagery of her waking up in the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 75 years, there's going to be a guy watching Sixth Sense going, wait, what?
He's a what?
Have either of you ever tried to sync up The Wizard of Oz to
No, but Dark I've always heard does it work? I've always heard about it.
I tried it. I think I was in high school. I could never get it to work. That and we spent an inordinate amount of time trying to find the actor who reportedly committed suicide on the set.
It's a peacock tail.
Interesting.
What most people think is that it's one of the actors who is, and we had this in my film class in high school, actually, because we went through all of the things that you supposedly can see.
It's a wild, like Wizard of Oz for some reason has a ton of like urban legends around.
But one of the big ones, if you don't know, is there's this urban legend that you can see one of the actors who played a munchkin hanging himself in the background. Right. Yes. And what you're actually seeing, because it looks like you see a dark figure swinging from the trees. But if you look at the image, what you're seeing is a peacock's feather going back and forth. You just have to follow that dark shade that's swinging and follow it. And it's connected to a peacock. And the same thing, like, what is it? Is it Three Men and a Baby that
the
you
ghost
can see the
that's
the
reflected?
Ghost?
Yeah.
And you know what that is?
Isn't it a cardboard cutout from Ted Danson's character?
Yeah, it was a stand-in that they someone was supposed to take off the set, but instead they hid it behind a curtain and you can see it.
It's kind of creepy when you see it.
It catches you off guard. I remember as a kid being told that and like being showed that and being like, oh.
And then a young Mike Flanagan was like, I've got an idea.
Yeah, these are great urban legends. I love stuff like this. All right. So time for you guys to play along. You are the new hosts of Awards Blend. Head to the comments under the YouTube video and let us know right now. What would be your pick for Best Picture? If you're down there as well, too, let us know some things that you're planning on seeing in December that might disrupt the race, whether it be The Brutalist, which is coming out to more theaters. Maybe Nosferatu coming out to some theaters. And what else? Craven the Hunter. That could.
There's more on Christmas Day. What else is coming out Christmas?
Oh, there's
Baby
a lot
Girl.
Of stuff. Baby Girl's coming.
Yeah. Which is what is my nickname for Gabe?
Complete unknown, which I'm have to run to right now. So we got to wrap this up. Okay. In the meantime, follow us on social media. At Jake Stakes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. And the show itself is at Real Blend. And guys, for the very last time, because it's in theaters now, Night Bitch.
If you like bacon, you'll love Oscar Mayer Thick Cut Bacon. It's smoked for 12 hours. That's a really long time. So for that delicious, smoky flavor, keep it Oscar. It's time for that once-a-year event, Truck Week, where you save big on America's biggest trucks, including the 12-ton, 12-liter, 12 hours of Oscar Mayer smoking thick cut bacon. For half the day, they're still smoking that bacon. If you're driven by your love of smoky, thick-cut bacon, keep it Oscar.